Okay. Very good. Did everybody get the sheet from Mahinda? Yeah, this is the sutta we're going to do now. So this is this particular sutta is almost like a transition sutta, how you go from mindfulness and how you move on to samadhi. So it's, in a sense, it's part of samasati, the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right? Mindfulness is, in a sense, part of that. And it shows you how you move from the right way of thinking about six different topics, and then move from there onto samadhi. And this kind of ties in with this idea that the idea of joy and happiness is so important on the Buddhist path, that it is the joy that kind of glues your mindfulness and allows samadhi, this deep states of meditation, eventually to arise. And this is basically how to help you to produce that joy in your meditation, to move the meditation forward. And this is very similar to, again, to the first sutta we saw before. You will see how these kind of, there are certain themes that repeat themselves throughout the suttas again and again in various contexts and various ways. And you'll see that as we go through this one. So this sutta is from the Anguttara Nikaya sixes. And it's called the sixes because there are six factors, things here. And this is sutta to Mahanama. Mahanama was a famous, he was a cousin of the Buddha's. He was one of the second clan, and he was a lay person. So this is actually teaching from the Buddha to a lay disciple. And this is how it goes. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sakyans at Kapilavatu in the Banyan Tree Park. Then Mahanama the Sakyan approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side and said to the Blessed One, Bhante, how does a noble disciple who has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching often dwell? And arrived at the fruit, understood the teaching, basically means somebody who is an Arya, somebody who has seen with insight the Buddhist teachings for themselves. Mahanama, a noble disciple who has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching, often dwells in this way. Here, Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects the Tathagata thus. The Blessed One is an Arahant, perfectly enlightened, accomplished in the true way, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, fortunate, knower of the world, unsurpassed, trainer of persons to be tamed, teachers of devas and humans, the enlightened one or the awakened one, the Blessed One. When a noble disciple recollects the Tathagata, on that occasion, his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, or delusion. On that occasion, his mind is simply straight, based on the Tathagata. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. When he is joyful, rapture arises. For one with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, the mind is stilled. This is called a noble disciple who dwells in balance amid an unbalanced population, who dwells unafflicted amid an afflicted population. As one who has entered the stream of Dhamma, he develops recollection of the Buddha. So this is this famous Buddha Nusati, right, that you have no doubt heard about if you have been around the Buddhism for a long time. Buddha Nusati, the recollection of the Buddha. And as you can see here, it goes through exactly the same sequence of steps that we were talking about at the very, very first day, the very first Saturday when we came last week. And the same steps, right? The joy leads to the rapture, leads to the tranquility, leads to the deep kind of happiness, the pleasure is called here, which then leads on to samadhi. And this shows you how it whole thing gets started. It gets started by contemplating the Buddha in the right way. Here it's called recollection, anusati, because you're recalling the qualities of the Buddha. It's assuming that you already know what they are to some extent. So this is how it starts. This is how it's done. This is one way of giving rise to that joy. And here the Buddha gives six ways of doing this. So this passage here, the recollection, this is the same as the very famous Itipiso, Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho, Vijja Tarana Sampanno, Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro, Purisa Dhamma Sarati Satta Deva Manusanang, Buddho Bhagava. That's the one you see that quoted, right? It's the one that people chant all over the Buddhist world when they go to the, you know, when they do pujas, etc. This is like a very standard chant that is done everywhere. The homage to the Triple Gem, and this is the homage to the Buddha. But it's very useful to reflect a little bit on what this means. So when you chant this the next time, you have some feeling for what it means. And the more you kind of more idea you have for what these things mean, the more powerful they become, and the more they actually involve you also your emotions. It's not an intellectual thing. The whole point here is to involve the emotions so that you actually feel a sense of joy when this when you reflect on these things. It is not easy to necessarily do this. It is not natural for many people. But if you can do that, it becomes this force in meditation that eventually takes you towards samadhi. So what does this mean? And again, the Blessed One is an arahant. Literally means he's a worthy one, is what an arahant actually means. But it means like somebody who's attained the pinnacle of perfection. Perfectly awakened, right? I like the idea of awakened rather than enlightened, in that you have awakened to the truth. Your eyes have kind of opened up. Now I understand. Now I see. And the idea of seeing things as they actually are, right, is a waking up experience. And you have done this to the highest possible extent. You are perfectly awakened. You're no longer, there's no delusion there anymore. There is the full seeing of the truth. And that is what a Buddha is all about. And I should say here, perhaps, before I go on with the rest of these qualities of the Buddha, it's important to remember that always the Buddha is a human being, right? This is so important. And it's actually quite difficult for people to recognize the Buddha as a human, ordinary human being, because we're so used to kind of looking at the Buddha as something special. And in one way, he's special, but he's special while he is human. He has taken the humanity to its highest possible peak. That is what he has done. But he's not anything, still not, he hasn't gone beyond his humanity in a certain sense. He started off just like us, and he took it to the highest possible extent. That is what the Buddha is. And that is important to remember, because then these things start to really matter. They become important. They become something you can relate to in your own life. So he's awakened, he has understood the truth, right? Just like anyone else can understand the truth. He is accomplished in true knowledge and conduct. True knowledge, this is usually in the Pali Suttas, refers to, these are called the vijjas, and the word vijja is directly related to the English word wit, right? You say somebody of quick wit, somebody who's got the wits around them, somebody who's kind of got the, who's intelligent, basically. And here it has a very similar meaning in the Pali, vijja, somebody of true knowledge or true understanding, of deep understanding. And of course, these vijjas in the Pali Suttas, and we'll come to that later on when we finish off the Noble Eightfold Path, these vijjas are, in the end, they are the knowledge of past lives, the understanding of the laws of karma, and also seeing the Four Noble Truths. So this is what these three vijjas are. This is what the Buddha has understood. So what is that? What are these three things? And basically what they are. The first thing is he has understood the world as it actually is. He has seen things the way the world actually functions. So part of that is understanding rebirth, right? Most people are, okay, maybe there is rebirth, maybe there isn't, or some might reject it, or some might believe it, but very few actually know that there is such a thing. And that is the difference with the Buddha. And then there is the mechanism which drives rebirth, the idea of karma, how this drives you, you know, throughout samsara, around and around. But on a deeper level, it's also the understanding of non-self, and that is where the Four Noble Truths come in. This idea that there is no steering mechanism inside. There's nobody really here. And because there is no self, when you see that, you also at the same time, you understand that all of this is just a play of conditions playing out with nobody really being in charge, the world kind of moving around from place to from, you know, one experience to another experience. Life is just an endless series of experiencing, going from life to life. So this is like the true knowledge of the last one, is the real understanding of happiness and suffering, the full and final understanding of happiness and suffering in the world, the happiness and suffering in experience, right? How much happiness can you actually experience? How much suffering can you experience? In the end, as I said at the very beginning, the first noble truth, experience is suffering, right? This is what you see. There's nobody in charge. So this is the true knowledge of the Buddha, the understanding of happiness and suffering, right? So, and of course, when you understand that, and you understand that which is the very thing that everybody wants to move towards happiness, away from suffering, that is why it is true knowledge. It is the one knowledge that everybody in the end is interested in. It is that, you know, as a feeling being, you are interested in what gives rise to happiness in the world, and what takes away suffering, of course. That is why it is true knowledge. And the important thing in Buddhism as well is that true knowledge, it has consequences for a person. If you have a real insight into existence, if you see how the world works, it affects you profoundly as a human being. And one of the things that it does, according to the suttas, it destroys all your defilements, right? Now, if all defilements are destroyed, it means that you're no longer capable of doing bad things. There's no motivating force inside of you to motivate you to act out of greed, to act out of anger, to act out of delusion. That has been destroyed. It means that your conduct is always going to be wholesome, always going to be good. There is nothing inside of you that can drive you in the wrong way anymore. So it has a very profound effect on your conduct. Right, and this is why, of course, it is possible for us to sometimes to look into the world and see these sort of people who have gone a long way on this path, and recognize them because they are changed, they are different, and the Buddha says that just seeing an arahant in the world is a tremendous blessing, because you're seeing something which is different, right? It's like, whoa, what is this? This is different. This person has something else. This person has something that, you know, a kind of balance, a something in life. And of course, if you destroy the negative things, all the positive things become so powerful. The compassion becomes powerful. The patience becomes endless. The wisdom, all of these factors become so strong suddenly because all the negative ones have disappeared completely. So this is the power. The conduct is changed. So you see an arahant, and then you think, if you are ready, some people may not see it at all, but if you are ready, if you have some understanding of spiritual qualities, what is really worthwhile in this world, and you see somebody absolutely peaceful, you see the Buddha, right? It's like you stop in your tracks and you see, whoa. And then immediately you want to inquire what's going on here, and you want to listen. And this is how the Dhamma is often taught. It starts off with seeing the Buddha, we're seeing an arahant, and then because of that sight, you become interested to hear the teachings, because you realize there's something special going on here. And then when you hear the teachings, based on that vision of this person, then you listen and you take to heart what is going on. And this is why these teachings are so powerful, because they come from that. That's their source. So the conduct is there, right? So it's possible to have some idea whether somebody actually is awakened, or at least, or even on the path to awakening. You can have some idea because the conduct has changed. If you hear about crazy wisdom, you have very good reasons to doubt that, because according to the suttas, if you are wise, it actually should be reflected on the conduct. Crazy wisdom is always a little bit suspect. At least check out the conduct before you. That is a very important part of this. So it is accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, right? This is the Buddha. And the Buddha is fortunate. Fortunate here means sugato. Sugato literally means somebody has gone to like a good destination, right? You have gone to a good place. So you're fortunate in that sense, that you have gone to a good The highest possible destination is what the Buddha has gone to. And then he is knower of the world. And again, this is very similar to having true knowledge. True knowledge and knower of the world are really just two sides of the same coin. So knower of the world, it can be understood as knowing all the destinations, right? All the possibilities for rebirth and that sort of thing. It can be understood in that sense. But in the end, remember, the world is something personal. The world is really the world of experience, all the possible experiences that you can have. So even if you get reborn something else, it just means you have different types of experiences. That's really all it means. So your experiences are always changing. That's what it, essentially what it means. And each lifetime means that you are kind of limited to a certain type of experiences. You're not fully limited because you can go into samadhi and you can step out of that ordinary experience. But generally speaking, you are kind of, you have certain limits to what you can experience once you are reborn somewhere. So the idea of rebirth just expands the potential for experience. So the Buddha knows the whole possibility of experience. He knows everything that is possible to experience in the world, in terms of, especially in terms of happiness and suffering, right? Full understanding of happiness and suffering here. And that is really what it means to be a knower of the world, to have the full understanding of these things. And once you have the full understanding, then you can decide, right? What is it? Is it worthwhile going on? Is it possible to find absolute happiness and stay there? Is it possible to get rid of all suffering? And then you can, on that basis, because you have a full understanding, you can say whether you should reject everything and find the final awakening and to stop being reborn in samsara, or whether there is something within samsara that is worthwhile holding on to. So it's a full understanding of happiness and suffering. And this is, again, what makes the Buddha so wise. This is what wisdom is all about, right? The wisdom of understanding the very thing that all humans are craving for and yearning for. Having full insight into that, that is really the real meaning of wisdom. And I'm sure you will agree with that, because, you know, people you consider wise in your life are people who can help you, right? Get you on the right track, move you in the right direction, who have some special insight into how you should live and what you should do. And of course, the highest insight is the one who has the full understanding of these things. So intelligence can be so much. Intelligence in the world can be in so many different areas. But the real kind of intelligence is the one who has the full insight into the core thing that human beings or any being yearn for and aspire for, which is basically to be happy, to be free of suffering and free of problems. So that is really, in the end, the knower of the world, the unsurpassed trainer of tameable persons. That's my preferred translation, tameable persons. Some people are not tameable. You know what that means, right? It means that sometimes you are just so far away from the Dhamma. Your views are so stuck in concrete and you can't really, there's just no way you're going to be able to reach certain people. Which is, you can only have compassion for them, because what can you do? You know, you give them some, you know, give them pearls and they don't really understand that it is what it is. It's like, oh, that's right. That's the story of Ajahn Brahm, isn't it? In his the last story in Ajahn Brahm's book, The Opening Door of Your Heart, is the worm and his delightful truck of dung, right? Let go of me. I don't want to go to heaven. I want to stay in the dung, right? It is that one there. If somebody shows you, well, look at this. This is amazing things you can achieve on, you know, in life if you just do things in the right way. And they say, no, I don't want to have anything to do with that. I want to stay in my pile of dung. That's basically what it means. Okay, anyway. So, unsurpassed trainer or tameable people, the insight into the truth also implies the insight of the path. You understand that this, the way to achieve this is by purification, so you can attain samadhi and then insight. You understand how the whole path functions. This is one of the strange things about the real insight into the Dhamma, is that these things are sides of the same coin, right? You understand the reality of suffering. You understand the cause of that. And also you understand the path that leads to the ending of that. All of these things are actually the same insight. It happens in one moment, and it all is part of the same thing. So once you have that true knowledge, you are also the unsurpassable tamer, because you have the full understanding of the path. But there's something more about the Buddha that makes him the unsurpassed trainer of tameable people. And that is the fact that, remember what I was saying before, the Buddha, he has accomplished his task in this life. He is fully awakened. He has no more suffering. He has destroyed rebirth. He has done what he needs to do for himself. And then when he decides to go out into the world and teach everybody else, he does that only for one reason. He's finished, right? He doesn't need any fame. He doesn't want to be famous. He doesn't have a sense of self that needs to be kind of, you know, bolstered up and so he can feel good about himself. In fact, the Buddha always says in the suttas that fame is just a pain. He doesn't want to be famous. He says fame is one of those low types of happinesses that, you know, people in the world get attached to. But it's something that you have to be careful of. And the Buddha wants to have nothing with that. Why? Because pain is suffering, because it means that you have to meet more people, there's more noise, there's more business, there's more duties, there's more problems, and they're not interested in that at all. And so for the Buddha, there's only one driving thing that drives the Buddha always from the moment of his awakening till the time he dies. Only one thing, and that is compassion for other people and compassion for other beings. That's the only driving force. Everything he says, everything he does, everything he thinks pretty much is driven by this one thing, compassion. That is the only motivating force in the Buddha. Right? And that is one of the things that make you an unsurpassed trainer of tameable people. Because you only come from compassion. There's no wanting. You don't have any vested interest whatsoever. There's nothing in it for the Buddha apart from giving out to other people in the world. The only reason he does this is purely out of compassion. There's no attachments included with that, no desires, no ulterior motives of any kind. And that is what is so incredibly powerful about the Buddha. That means you can have full trust in his teachings, right? Full trust in what he says. Once you get your mind around that and you gain a certain confidence that that is actually the case, it means you get incredible faith and trust in these teachings. Because they come from an incredibly pure place, and they're only there to make us happy. Only purpose is to help us to become happy. And there was a sutta I was reading in the monastery recently. I may have mentioned that the other night, and where the Buddha says, I'm teaching this, listen to these teachings, I'm teaching this for only one reason, for your benefit and for your happiness. That's the only reason. And once you get your head around that, these teachings become much more, wow, you know, I better take this seriously, right? He's teaching this only for my benefit. So why shouldn't I take this incredibly seriously and really get into this? That's why they're there for. So this is the unsurpassed trainer of tameable people. Then he is teacher of devas and humans, teachers of gods and men is often, or gods and humans is often the mentioned there. And the idea with this is, of course, that simply that the Buddha is, once you have understood everything, the whole universe, all degrees of happiness everywhere, you are basically a teacher of everybody, you know, because you have the full understanding. Except if he meets another Buddha, then of course he wouldn't be a teacher of another Buddha or an arahant, but anyone who hasn't seen that truth, he would be the teacher of those. So he is the highest teacher, basically, the enlightened one, the awakened one, right? Again, the blessed one, the Bhagava, often translated as Lord. The word Bhagava often has the meaning of Lord in Indian language, especially. So this is how you reflect. And once you get into that, the idea is for that to give rise to some kind of to a joy. Remember that there is many ways of looking at this. What I'm giving you now is my way of looking at this particular paragraph. There's many different aspects, many different ways you can look at this. Of course, the advantage I have is that I have been studying these teachings for a long time, so I can maybe give you a few hints that you may not have thought of before. But reflect on them also in your own way, because you will find that we're all a little bit different, right? So your way of being inspired by this will be a little bit different from my way. So you can make this your own inspirational thing. And every time you chant Iti Piso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho Vijja Charana Sampanno, etc., then you remember some of these things, and that will make it much more powerful when you do that. Okay. I'm going to take advantage of this nice warm water which has been provided to me very kindly. Okay. So, then it says, when the noble disciple recollects the Tathagata, not the Tathagata as some people, the Tathagata. It's not the TH in English, it's just this is an Indian spelling, it's just a T, yeah. T with an aspiration, they say. Tathagata, the thus gone, is one of these mystical terms that is used to describe somebody who has gone to the end of the path in ancient India. So when you recollect the Tathagata in this way, on that occasion, his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, and delusion. This is basically shorthand for the five hindrances, right? You're not obsessed by these things. These things are basically dispelled from your mind when you reflect on the Tathagata in this way. So this is the point here, right? This is the opposite. This is a spiritual kind of happiness. It's a happiness which is very lofty and very beautiful. It kind of makes you look at the world in a different way. It takes you out of your ordinary perspective. And for that reason, it dispels all the defilements. The worldly things are no longer interesting. You're changing your perspective, looking in a different direction, understanding the world in a different way. Understanding the Buddha is part of this worldview, which looks at the world in an entirely new way, and seeing happiness where previously you thought it was suffering, and seeing suffering where previously you thought there was happiness. So the whole change in perspective. So these defilements are reduced, right? The hindrances fall down, and because of that, on that occasion, his mind is simply straight. Uju. We saw this word before. Somebody mentioned from the Metta Sutta, Uju and Suhuju, right? And they were talking about the different spellings there, and that is precisely the same word as straight here. So your mind is straight. The mind, which is full of defilements, is crooked, right? It's kind of leaning one way, leaning the other way. You don't see straightly as things are. But here's a straight mind. It sees things as it actually is. You're not crooked by the defilements. So the mind is simply straight, based on the Tathagata. A noble disciple whose mind is straight, right, because of that lack of defilements, gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma. The meaning is the Atta. The meaning is the goal that the Dhamma leads to. So the Dhamma is the doctrine, and then when you practice those teachings, that doctrine, it leads to, you can see where that is heading, right? This is the Atta. So it is like the meaning or the goal or the aim of the teachings. And you start to see, like the purpose, you start to understand the purpose of these things. You understand that this is something that actually is not just a teaching, right? It's actually something which has incredible power to change your life. And you can sort of see the goal ahead of you, the happiness, the destruction of suffering, all these kind of things. You get inspired because you see what this is all about. And this inspiration, Veda, is the Pali word. And it's an interesting word because, just like the English word inspiration, it combines a very positive feeling of being inspired, but also the idea of a certain amount of knowledge, a certain amount of understanding. You understand and you feel this inspiration at the same time. So you gain this inspiration in the meaning and also the Dhamma, the doctrine and the goal of that teaching. And then you gain joy connected with the Dhamma. This is Pamuja. Right, the joy connected with that teaching. And Pamuja, now if you go back again to the very first sutta that I was talking about on this retreat, which was called Chaitana, Volition, it talks about Sila, then from Sila comes non-remorse, then from non-remorse comes Pamuja. It's exactly the same word, right? And from here on, the sequence is exactly the same as it was in the first teaching that we're talking about. So the difference here from this teaching to the one we did on the first day or the first Saturday is only the very beginning part. In that beginning part, it starts off with virtue, with sila, and the whole thing comes. Here the beginning part is the recollection of the Tathagata, right? So these go together. And these things are not really divorced, right? If your sila is very good, it's much easier to understand what the Buddha is all about. if you reflect on the Buddha in the right way, it also improves your sila. These are very closely related to each other here. So it's not really so much an alternative, it's a slight alternative, but really it's like different aspects of the same thing in many ways. So, and then comes the rest, right? Because of that joy, the pamuja, now you kind of, the happiness is there. So at this point, maybe you bring that recollection of the Buddha together with you into the breath meditation, perhaps, right? You kind of combine things a little bit. This is one of the things. You can combine things a little bit in the meditation practice. That the recollection of the Buddha is still at the back of your mind as a powerful source of joy here. And then you start watching the breath, and the joy becomes more powerful. It goes into piti. Rapture, the rapture moves into tranquility. Tranquility becomes pleasure. The pleasure, then the mind becomes stilled, concentrated, as it says here. And then, because of that, you dwell in balance amid an unbalanced population. You are balanced because you are not subject to these defilements in the same way. Whoever you see, whoever you meet, you don't become upset or angry. Your mind is balanced. Your mind is even, right? There's not so much up and downs as it is for the minds of most ordinary people. Unafflicted, right? It's the same kind of thing. An affliction, these defilements that come, they are afflictions because they are painful and they are troublesome and they are things that we don't really want. So as one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops the Buddhanusati, the recollection of the Buddha. So here you can see here this transition, right? The transition from how we give rise to joy. And this is all using mindfulness, right? So the more powerful that mindfulness is at the beginning, the more ability you have to recall these kind of things, recall the Buddha and recall these things. There's a connection between sati, samasati, anusati, recollection, and then the achievement of samadhi as a consequence of that. So that is the first way here, recollection of the Buddha. That is then the second way is the recollection of the Dhamma. And I don't have, now that we have gone through it, each one is going to go progressively faster because there is less to say about each one. So let's have a quick look at this one here. Again, Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects the Dhamma thus. The Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One, directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable to be personally experienced by the wise. When a noble disciple recollects the Dhamma, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, or delusion. On that occasion his mind is simply straight, based on the Dhamma. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. When he is joyful, rapture arises. For one with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. One feeling pleasure, the mind is stilled. This is called the noble disciple who dwells in balance amid an unbalanced population, who dwells unafflicted amid an afflicted population. And one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of the Dhamma. So exactly the same principle, right? But this time based on thinking about the teaching rather than the Buddha. Of course, there isn't that much distinction, right, between the Buddha and the teaching and even the Sangha and the training. These things are very closely related to each other. Because once you have confidence that there is somebody who has awakened to the truth, then of course those teachings will be in accordance with that, right? And once you have confidence that certain teachings are the good teachings, you know there must be somebody behind those teachings who actually awaken to the truth. So they're very closely related to each other. But the Dhamma is well expounded by the Buddha, right? Because he is fully awakened, you know you're getting the real deal, as they say here. This is not some dodgy doctrine. This is the real deal, the best possible teaching here. And then you have all these qualities here. It's directly visible and immediate. This means basically the same thing. This is sandhittika and akalika. And it means that you can see these things in this life. These are not things that you have to wait for till after you die, but is available in this very life. If you practice the path correctly, they are available right here, right now. That's what it means. One of those great qualities of the Dhamma is that you don't have to wait until some uncertain future after you die, when you cannot, that you cannot really know anything about. Inviting one to come and see, ehi pasiko, come and see, quite literally. In other words, just do it and then see for yourself. Applicable opanayiko means that you apply the teaching and it moves you forward, and to be personally experienced by the wise. So you got to be a bit wise, right? This is kind of the catch 22. If you haven't got a little bit of wisdom to begin with, it makes it harder. But if you have a little bit of straight seeing to start off with, then there is a chance that you will move forward on this path. One of the things that comes out of all this is this thing that we were talking about the other day in the Samiddhi Sutta, which is about monk Samiddhi and the Deva, and the Deva comes down to him and says, forget about this Dhamma business, you know, it's sometime in the future, sensual pleasures are here and now. And he says, no, it's the other way around. The Dhamma is here and now. Sensual pleasures are with the future. And this is one of the things that makes the Dhamma, Sandhittika, right here. It is visible right here, right now. One of those powerful things that if you practice in the right way, right now, if you're able, and you sit down, and you're able by thinking in the right way to dispel defilements to a certain degree, right away you feel the happiness and pleasure that comes from that. Right? It is immediately visible. Right here, right now, if you do an act of kindness, straight away, you feel the results of that right away. This is, in a sense, it is applicable right away. And it has an immediate effect on us right here. And also the knowledge of the defilements and all of these things, their causality, all of these happen right now in this present moment. So that is the Dhamma and why it is so powerful, because it does have immediate results. It doesn't always work, right? Sometimes you do these things, it doesn't give that kind of happiness perhaps, but in principle it does. And when you get it right, you know that it does when you get it right. Okay, so let us move on to the Sangha. Again, the Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects the Sangha thus. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples, so this is the Arya Sangha, the noble Sangha, is practicing the good way, practicing the straight way, practicing the true way, practicing the proper way. That is the four pairs of person, the eight types of individual. This Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. And when noble disciple recollects the Sangha, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, and delusion. On that occasion his mind is simply straight, based on the Sangha. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the meaning, inspiration in the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. When he is joyful, he gets rapture. With rapture, he becomes tranquil. With tranquility, he feels pleasure, and then the mind becomes stilled. And this is called the noble disciple who lives in balance amidst an unbalanced population, who dwells unafflicted amidst an afflicted population. And as one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of the Dhamma. So that is the recollection of the Sangha. And this refers to the noble Sangha. That's why they are said to be practicing the good way. Good way means supatipanno, right? I'm sure all of you know these things already by heart, right? The supatipanno, ujjupatipanno, nyayapatipanno, samichipatipanno, etc. These are the ordinary recollections. I forgot to say it on the Dhamma, but the Dhamma is exactly the same thing. The standard verses or Dhamma that we hear all the time. Svakato, Dhammo, Sandhittiko, Akaliko, Ehipasiko, etc. And here we have the Sangha. Supatipanno, Bhagavato, Savaka Sangho. And all of these things are just the path which is Once you become a noble disciple, you have entered the path, you have seen the path for yourself, you know what the path is, and that's why it is the good path, right? The good practice, practicing the good way, practicing the straight way. It's a way which is straight because you know all the factors in your mind heading in the right direction. Proper way, true way, again, because you know the path. So it's the true practice and the proper practice. These are all different ways just of saying that you have understood what the path is all about. The four pairs of person, the eight types of individual, these are just all the different types of people, just different classifications of people who are awakened to some extent. They have the minimum requirement of stream entry or just before stream entry. So they're just different ways of looking at these different people, really, all the way up to arahantship. And they are worthy of hospitality, etc. And this is interesting. Why are they worthy of hospitality, gifts, offerings, and a reverential salutation? What is the reason for that? One of the main reasons is that these people have so much to give to everybody. They have the key, right? The secret. They have that combination, right? To that safety valve, the safety vault that everybody wants to get into, right? The vault which gives the secret to life itself, what life is all about, the purpose of life, the secret to finding the highest happiness and getting rid of all suffering. That is what they have. That's what they know, right? So they have the highest gift to give to anybody in the world. And because they have the highest gift to give to you, it's just like a teacher in school, right? A teacher in school teaches you the basics to get by. Your parents teach you all the kind of things in life to make you be able to live this life. But these Aryas, the noble ones, they have the secret, the teaching, the highest kind of teaching that is possible in this world. The secret to happiness itself, the secret to the highest kind of happiness. And that's why they are worthy of offerings, right? Because what we give to them is always going to be much less than what they can offer us in return. So just like you have gratitude to any teacher who really benefits you, in the same way, you have the idea is to have the highest gratitude to somebody who can give you the highest teachings in this way. So this is what the Arya Sangha is about. And remember, you don't really know who this Arya Sangha is, right? So often what you do is you support wherever you know that it is likely that there will be some Aryas. And this is why often in Buddhism, if you want to offer something to the monastic community, you give to the whole monastic community, both present and also for the future. So if you, let's say you give a donation to build a kuti, right? You're building that kuti for the whole Sangha, and you have no idea who is going to be able to live in that kuti in the future. And this is what that makes it so powerful. Instead of focusing on individuals, you can never know which individuals, you know, have the who have the full understanding. Just because somebody is able to, you know, expound the Dhamma and talk about the suttas in a nice way doesn't necessarily mean that they have a very profound understanding of the Dhamma. Teaching is one thing. Actually having the full experience is something else. These are not always... So it's very hard to make that judgment. And for that reason, it's always good to instead give to the whole Sangha. Give to this group of people, you know, where it is likely to go to good use. So this is why these people are worthy of gifts, right? And one of the other things about when you reflect about the Sangha, they are practicing the good way, etc. How do we relate to that? What does it mean that the Sangha is practicing the good way? And one way of relating to that is to think of some of those stories of people who practice and real in a way which is so outlandish, right? So different from what we are used to living our ordinary lives. Because some of these people who I have met personally, who you hear stories about, the way they live their life, it's just astonishing, and it's very hard to understand how anybody can live that way unless they have seen something which is very much beyond what ordinary people see and understand in their life. Now, I've been telling these stories in various Buddhist groups all over the place recently, or at least some of these stories. One of these stories is this is a monk in Sri Lanka. And this monk in Sri Lanka, he lives in the jungle in Sri Lanka. Now, in Sri Lanka, the jungle is real jungle. It's not like the bush in Australia, this is a real jungle, right? Absolutely dense trees, canopies. You can't see the sky right above your head because the jungle is so dense, with creepers growing anywhere, lots of wild animals, panthers and elephants that can trample you down, and lots of snakes, of course, and lots of insects and bugs of all kind of leeches and all kind of things. I know quite a few monks who live in the jungle, live in similar situations in Sri Lanka, and they all tell these stories about what it is like to live in the jungle. And I've been there myself a couple of times, and just seeing it is very magnificent when you see this kind of original jungle. It's very beautiful and awe-inspiring and very Anyway, this particular monk, he lives in the jungle. And he disappears into the jungle, right? And he stays there for 51 weeks of the year. Then he comes out for 1 week and he has kind of discussion with all his monastic friends, right? It's good you have a bit of discussion so he can teach a little bit. And then he kind of disappears into the jungle again, right? For another 51 weeks of the year. And when he lives in the jungle, he doesn't see anybody. All he ever does, he goes to the village to get alms from the local villagers. There are little villages spread around. So you go to the village, you get your alms, and maybe he gives a little blessing, maybe he says a few words of encouragement about Dhamma, but there's not much exchange going on, right? Very little exchange. He gets the food, goes back to his kuti. And that is the only contact he has with human beings, right? Every day, week after week after week, like that. And the way he lives, this particular monk, he's the one who started a whole kind of movement in Sri Lanka of living in huts that only have three walls. So these huts that are on stilts, so they're a little bit above ground, so that the animals can't just walk straight in, right? That's what it's like. If you only have three walls, basically anyone can walk straight in. So they're on stilts, and then you only have three walls, right? So one wall is open, and the idea is for it to be a bit like a cave, right? So he says that very often in the morning when you wake up, there will be some animals next to you, right? Like sleeping next to you, like a snake or something, you know. Good morning, snake, or whatever. And that's how he lives his life, right? And very, very simple. There's no modcons or anything like that, right? Very, very simple. You have your robe. You have maybe I don't know exactly what he has in there, but basically it's nothing. You sleep pretty much straight on the plank floor of that hut in the forest. And that is how he lives his life. So you may ask, how is that possible? And it's a very good question. How indeed is it possible? And the Buddha says elsewhere in the sutta that unless you have samadhi, this is the kind of situation which drives you crazy after a while. You can't handle it. Very little contact with humans. Living in great, basically living a very, very simple life. So then when people live like that year after year, decade after decade, and not only don't they go crazy, but they thrive, right? They come out and they are wiser than before. They don't have these big crazy eyes, but they actually have real they have real wisdom, right? They have real wisdom when they come out. And this is when you start to understand that there is something more in the world. There's something in the world which is very profound, and it gives you a feeling that, you know, these people are actually practicing the right way. So this is one way of looking at this practice of the Sangha, right? What does Sangha really mean? Who are these people who are Aryas? This monk here, I would say, it is very likely that he is an Arya. He has full insight into these teachings. So there was more stories about him, but I think we're running a bit late, so I will just leave that for now. But another example would be Ajahn Brahm sitting in his cave, not in his cave, in his kuti for 6 months, right? For 6 months, he didn't have any contact. He didn't even go to the village for alms. He had absolutely zero contact for 6 months. And all he did was stay in his kuti, which is exactly 7.2 square meters, right? So very, very small. And then the walking path outside. And then he would walk down to pick up his bowl once a day where the food was, and then walk back to the kuti. It's only about 100 meters. And that's where he stayed, within that space, for 6 months, going nowhere else. And he said that one day he had seen one of the monks, right? This is one of his disciples. But he had been on retreat for 4 months and doing nothing and just living in his own space. He couldn't even remember the name of this monk anymore. It was like everything was kind of... he was so secluded, so far away from everything else. And then when he comes out of that thing, and again, Ajahn Brahm really literally doesn't go anywhere, just on this tiny little space for 6 months. The only thing he had in his cutie was a copy of the Majjhima Nikaya, right, the suttas. And then he comes out and then he says, 6 months of bliss, right? 6 months of bliss, that is kind of the first thing here. And then the first talk he gives is this very inspirational talk on the bliss of, you know, of being able to stay by yourself like that for 6 months when your meditation is very, very profound. And again, it gives rise to the sense that, wow, there is something in this world that is beyond the ordinary, beyond the normal. It gives a sense of hope, right? A sense of inspiration. And this is what a true practitioner, a real Sangha member should be like. There should be an inspiration for everybody else. They're practicing the straight path, practicing the real path, the proper path. And this is how, this is a little bit how you can reflect on these people. And sometimes I'm focusing now on the monastic community because it is in the monastic community that probably you find the most extreme examples, right? But sometimes you will find also in the lay community there are certain people who are very inspiring in the same way. Not in perhaps exactly those terms, but in other ways as well. So these are some of the ways of reflecting on the Sangha. There are many more stories, but I think we will leave it at that so I can... move on to the last two or three of these factors. Okay. Again, Mahanama, a noble disciple recollects his own virtuous behavior, the sila, as unbroken, flawless, unblemished, unblotched, freeing, praised by the wise, ungrasped, and leading to stillness. When a noble disciple relaxes his own virtuous behavior, his own sila, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, and delusion. On that occasion his mind is simply straight, based on virtuous behavior. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. When he is joyful, rapture arises. For one with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. When tranquil in body, feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, the mind becomes stilled. This is called the noble disciple who dwells in balance amidst an unbalanced population, who dwells unafflicted amidst an afflicted population. As one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of virtuous behavior. So this is a very, very similar now to the first sutta we did, where virtue stands at the beginning, right? You have sila, and as a consequence of having sila, all the rest kind of flows and happens as a consequence of that. And the ideal way is that your sila is so established that when you just relax and you kind of calm down and you become peaceful, it's as if that sila, that virtue you are practicing, it just comes through by itself. You don't have to recollect very much. It's just that when mindfulness becomes established, then these are the things that you are naturally mindful of. You have a natural awareness of your own good conduct over a long period of time. But sometimes you can help that along a little bit by, you know, allowing the mind to don't use much force. If you use too much force, it's not going to work. But just very lightly and gently direct your mind into onto the fact that you have been living a very harmless and good life for a long period of time. And this is one of the things, you know, when the Buddha talks about virtue and kindness and harmlessness in the suttas, he says that you are actually, by doing that, you're giving a very powerful and important gift to the people in the world. You're giving the gift of freedom from fear. You're giving the gift of trust. You're giving the gift that people are not afraid of you anymore. Other people feel they can trust you. They can relax around you. That is a very powerful psychological gift when people feel they can relax in your presence, right? One thing is giving material things, but here you're actually giving them something much deeper than that. And you can see that in the animals as well. You can see that the animals at Bodhinyana Monastery, the kangaroos and everything else, they become just more and more tame, right? And eventually they become so tame, they almost can become too tame. This is the problem with animals. When they become too unafraid of you, they start to become bossy and they want to boss you around and they want to do things. I've told this story before, but many years ago I was sitting on my walking path eating my dana. You know, I sometimes we take our food back to our cuties. I was sitting there, and then as I was sitting there, this kangaroo comes in from the other end of the walking path, and it kind of looks at me, and then starts walking up towards me. It's coming closer and closer and closer and closer. The walking path is about 18 meters long, so there's a few steps, right? And eventually, it comes all the way up to me, and I'm wondering what's going on. This is like one of the old friends, so I have some idea what is going on. And then, as it's standing there, it kind of looks into my bowl, right? I'm eating. And then as it's looking into my bowl, it starts to lower down its head. It's obviously going to eat my food, right? So quickly, I take my hands, cover all my bowl. And then the most amazing thing happens when I do that. It takes its little front paws, right? Little front legs. It puts it onto my arms and tries to pull them apart. Right? That is... So that's what happens when you are kind to the animals. They respond, but sometimes they become a little bit too friendly. So I had just, at that point, I get up and I have to push the kangaroo away. And then later on, I give it the remains of what I have in my bowl. But so that is one of those examples. But it's actually quite beautiful, right? It means that the animals are relaxing. They're feeling at ease in your presence. Actually, it's quite nice. Usually, kangaroos are very fearful beings. They see you from far away, and they run straight away, right? They know that human beings are dangerous. We have weapons. We have all these kind of crazy things. And they are very afraid of us. So actually, it is quite beautiful when you see that. And the same thing with people as well. People feel at ease in your presence, right? It's like a story with Ajahn Brahma said the other day, who walks into this hall with this monk in the corner, right? And suddenly you just relax completely, because you cannot help being relaxed in the presence of a person who is so absolutely peaceful and so completely unjudging, right? There's no judgment. They accept you 100% for who you are. No judgment whatsoever. Usually we feel that people judge us, at least a little bit, right? Now, for the first time in your life, no judgment, and you can just be yourself, which means you can relax. So this is the power of virtue. It can be very, very powerful. And when you think about it in the right way, when you practice in the right way, this is how, again, learn to reflect on these things in your own way. These are just some guidelines, basically. So I'm going to quickly have a look at number 5. I will skip number 6 because it's a little bit perhaps specialized, but number 5 I will do quickly because this actually is a very important one, just to at least read it through, although we might go a few minutes over time. Again, Mahanama, a noble disciple recollects his own generosity thus. It is truly my good fortune and gain that in a population obsessed by the stain of stinginess, of miserliness, I dwell at home with a mind devoid of the stain of miserliness, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. When a noble disciple recollects his generosity, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, and delusion. On that occasion his mind is simply straight, based on generosity. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. When he is joyful, rapture arises. When he is rapture, he becomes tranquil. With tranquility, he feels pleasure. Feeling pleasure, his mind becomes stilled. This is called a noble disciple who dwells in balance amidst an unbalanced population, who dwells unafflicted amidst an afflicted population. As one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of generosity. Right? It's interesting, isn't it? You remember your generosity in this way, and the first thing it says is your reflection. Well, look at all these other people. They're all stingy, but I am generous, right? How fortunate I am. Right? This is the first thing it says there. Sometimes we think, oh, all these stingy people, they are no good, and you kind of lift yourself up. But actually, what you understand, because you understand the power of generosity, you understand that you are fortunate who are able to be generous, right? Other people haven't understood the power of generosity, and because they haven't understood it, they are not capable of being generous in the same way. But because you have understood the power of this, you feel happy because you have understood that, and because you are able to act accordingly. It's a wonderful way of reflecting. You don't become upset at others for not doing the right thing. Rather, you understand your own good luck in actually having grasped what is going on here. And then, because you understand the power of this, we have talked a lot about generosity already on this retreat. I'm not going to add all that much more to that. But the idea that you are freely generous, right? You come to the point, you develop generosity in the way we were talking about at the beginning. You keep on developing this, and your mind eventually just becomes more generous until one day you get this feeling that you just want to give, right? It's like your heart opens up to everybody and you always want to be of assistance. And this is one of the qualities, again, of the Aryas, the noble people. They have an endless willingness to serve and to help and to be of assistance in the world. And this is, I think, a good way of looking at yourself. If you are a monk you are able to assist, it's not to think of yourself as something high which everybody else should bow down to and should kind of look after, but rather you should look at yourself as a person who is of service to other people, right? And that is a much more powerful way of looking at things, because that gives you happiness. The fact that other people are kind to you and whatever, that's fine, but that is not where the real happiness comes from. The real happiness, if you think correctly, comes from the service that you provide to others. Right? And that is a great way, a good way, much better way of looking at this. And this is how the Aryas will look at the world. They will look at the world understanding that this is... you are freely generous. It's a wonderful thing to have that free generosity inside. Open-handed, right? Delighting in relinquishing things. Devoted to charity. Etc., etc. So feel that feeling for yourself. When you feel that feeling sometimes coming up inside of you, and see how beautiful it is, and how it is not... It cannot coexist together with the defilements of the mind, just like the reflection on virtue. When that feeling is there, there are no defilements in the mind, and then this natural progression happens, and it takes you to stillness and samadhi as a consequence. So that is very briefly about generosity as well. So again, don't try to force these things when you meditate, but just sit back and very carefully allow the mind to go back to a experience that you feel that was an experience of kindness, of generosity, that had a powerful impact on you. And the mind will dig those experiences up by itself. Why? Because they did make a powerful impact in the past, so they're fairly close, fairly easy to remember in the present moment. And then you will be doing this kind of recollection. Okay, so that is enough for this afternoon, so I will see you again this evening here.